On Reality Check this week, we've got an interview with Dennis Triglio, one of our city councilors. We'll be talking about the current issues of public concern facing our council, as well as hearing a lot about monarch butterflies and our status as one of the few towns on the West Coast to be designated a monarch city, USA. I'm Lee, your host, and this is Dennis Triglio. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Lee. How are you?
I'm good. I'd love to start off with the monarchs and understanding what this designation as being a monarch city means and what's involved with that.
Sure. I was going to start with going into why I was interested in
sure. Tell us that. I'd love to hear.
Sure. I would like for monarchs to be around for future generations to enjoy as much as I've enjoyed them from when I was a kid growing up in New York. So I got interested in their conservation and captive rearing of monarch butterflies, and there were several other people here, including Vicky Meehan, who started Brookings Oregon Monarch Advocates, or BOMA, and she also has a Facebook page for the group, monarchs.me, where you can ask questions if you're interested in learning more about this. While I was on the council, I became aware of a program called the Monarch City USA, to which you referred just now, Lee. And what it is, since we have several people here who are interested in raising monarchs and who are in the process of raising them, it became apparent to me that Oregon didn't have any monarch cities in it. So I thought if we applied for this designation, then we would be the first city in Oregon. So I passed it by the city council, and they issued a proclamation declaring June Monarch Butterfly Month.
Oh,
and
wow.
And then as a result of that proclamation, which gave us some credibility with Monarch City USA, we applied and we agreed to several things. And one of them is hosting a Monarch Festival every year.
Really? When do we do that?
We're hoping to do it. It's tentative at this point. We're having another meeting soon, but on August the 18th, which is a Saturday. I place to be determined as of yet.
Uh-huh. What are your hopes and dreams for how that's going to look?
I've been going around giving seminars, as has Vicky and other BOMA members.
Uh-huh.
Locally and sometimes in different towns.
Right.
Just trying to generate interest in this. It's really interesting because monarch butterflies seem to be interesting to people regardless of political affiliation, regardless of age. I mean, there are tiny kids that are really interested in it, to senior citizens that are doing it. And it's kind of a great uniter in a way. It's a feel-good thing,
yeah,
to do that. And so my hopes is just to get as many people as possible involved. As of about a year ago, Oregon had, I think, a total of 80 monarch way stations, and five of them were in Brookings and Harbor. And so we became sort of a hotspot. And originally, they didn't even know that Brookings was on the migratory pathway for monarchs. And
so when you say a way station, what does that mean?
Oh, a monarch way station is, there's a group called Monarch Watch that's on the internet, and they do a lot of things and print a lot of articles on monarch butterflies. They offer people the possibility to get a monarch way station with a registered number in it in their backyard. I have one in mine. I call it the Pura Vida patch, or the Good Life patch.
Yes.
And basically what you have to have there is food. So for the caterpillars, that would be milkweed, which I can talk about in more detail.
Sure.
That's for the caterpillars. Then food for the adults would be nectar flowers, so that the adults can get sugar that they convert to fat for their for storage, especially for the migratory population. Shelter, which would be woody trees and shrubs to protect the monarchs at night and during inclement weather. and water, because mud puddles provide moisture and nutrients for the butterflies. So if you can provide these things, you would then apply to Monarch Watch for certification as a Monarch Waste Station. And so my backyard is a little Monarch Waste Station.
That sounds great.
So, yeah,
so
great.
That's how you evolve into being a Monarch City. You started to tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So the Monarch City thing, as I said, we try to encourage the planting of milkweed, which is the host plant for the mm-hmm. monarch butterfly. Different butterflies have different host plants. Mm-hmm. The monarchs are very specific to that. You'll rarely see a monarch egg, if ever, on a plant that isn't milkweed. And these are the butterflies just know what milkweed is. If they were to lay it on a plant that wasn't milkweed, the egg would die because it wouldn't eat. Because as soon as the little caterpillar hatches out of the tiny little egg, the first thing it does is eats its own shell and then starts eating the leaf that it's on. And the thing about milkweed is milkweed in itself is a poisonous plant. And the monarchs have developed some sort of biological or biochemical system where they can tolerate these cardiac glycosides, I think they're called. But when they eat them, they do store them in their body. So if a bird or another predator tries to get them, or they see, or they recognize, okay, that's an orange and black butterfly with this pattern, I better stay away from it because it didn't taste good the last time I ate one.
It killed my dad.
But it's part of their defense mechanism in light of so many different predators that they have.
Wow, that's so, really interesting.
Yeah.
So then, on the way to becoming a Monarch City, mm-hmm. what happened? We were waste stations. There were five of us here in town out of 80.
Right.
And then what happens?
Those all are factors that would weigh into you being approved as a Monarch City. Trying to encourage other people to get involved. As I mentioned, having the Monarch Festival, there were a list of 10 things, and I didn't bring them in front of
that's
me now
because okay.
it's been a year.
But that's general idea that you're going to promote
general things,
it.
Exactly,
and so,
right.
And we're the only one in Oregon?
We're still the only, we got certified last May, and we're still the only city in Oregon to have that certification. There's a lot of monarch conservation work being done in the Medford area, mm-hmm. But they haven't applied for the designation, as far as I know.
Right.
And I guess it helped a little bit that I was on the council because you needed the council's buy-in as well.
Approval and all, right. Yeah. So, but I think if I remember when I heard you talk the other day, there's only a handful of these monarch cities in the West Coast. In its entirety, is that right?
That's correct. I think there are probably, when we got the designation, I think there might have been only maybe 10 at the most, and that was mostly on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, and also Missouri. And since we've joined, there have been some in Arkansas, in Florida.
But in the West, there's only a handful.
I think there are more. There's sort of the Western Monarch and the Eastern Monarch, which mm-hmm. are separate migrations. And I think right now there are probably more Monarch cities on the Eastern side than on the Western side.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right.
Yeah, there's only a handful out here.
Mm-hmm.
And there are these two migration patterns, which I guess we should talk maybe a little bit about.
Sure.
Why? I mean, that's one of the really big things why people are fascinated by monarchs. Not only do they have wonderful mm-hmm. defensive strategy and they're beautiful and all of that, but they do this incredible exodus.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that lifestyle and the flight plan and what
sure.
they do?
Sure. Well, from when the season begins, there are actually four generations of butterflies that are born, and the mm-hmm. the first three generations only live long enough to basically make it out of the chrysalis, mate, lay eggs, and within 6 weeks they're gone. But the final generation is what we call a super generation, and they're born later in the August, September time frame here in Brookings. And these live for a total of 9 months. So when they come out, they gorge themselves on as much nectar as possible so that they can build up good fat stores for a long flight that they have ahead of them. And they then fly down, in the case of the Western monarch, mostly to overwintering sites in California. The Eastern monarchs will migrate into Mexico. But I've seen a study, I think it was in 2012, where they did report finding some Western monarchs in Mexico laying among the dead that didn't quite make it out of the overwintering colony, but that did show that they can migrate as far south as Mexico.
Interesting, yeah.
And one of the things that we do that I'm involved in to deal with migration is we actually raise the monarch butterflies through five caterpillar stages and then a chrysalis, and then the chrysalis emerges and we have a butterfly. And then we apply a little adhesive tag to their wing that has a code number and an email address on it. So when it's found or spotted by someone, they can email the email address with the code number, and then we will know where exactly that butterfly came from. Some of them have even been sighted several times on the way down, which is an even better way to track their migratory pathways. This past year, I raised from eggs 89 butterflies that I released, and three of them were found in the Santa Cruz area. And there's nothing more more exciting to me. I know I'm a science nerd, but than having a butterfly that you know that you raised and that you released, and it was found 500 miles away. It's
That's
just
wonderful.
Incredible. Yeah, it's a great feeling.
So I'm trying to understand their pathway, because I believe. How far north do they go, say, on the West Coast?
I'm pretty sure into British Columbia. I know they're in Canada, so I would say on the West Coast, that would be British Columbia.
Right, and then they will fly as far as Southern California? Generally, not...
California generally,
Mexico,
certainly to California. Yeah.
I know when I was in high school, a million years ago, I think this is 1965, okay? I'm aging myself here. But we would get off the school bus, and the boys, of course, they'd take a rock and they'd throw it up in the tree, and there would be this enormous flight of probably 1,000 mm-hmm. monarchs would fly out of that tree. It was just amazing. It was just an unbelievable show, of nature.
It really is.
And that was in Cambria, California.
Oh, okay.
Central California.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And since 1980, the monarch population has declined by 95%. So the numbers are way down.
Well, that's what the fuss is about, right?
Right. And when I was down in Monterey in Pacific Grove in the, I think it was in the early 80s, I was at an immunology conference at Asilomar. I saw the monarchs gathering for the wintering site, and they hang from the trees just in masses of black and orange. It's just it's really fantastic.
Stunning.
It's something you'll never forget once you see it.
And
I recommend everybody try to put that on their bucket list. But that was fascinating back then, and. Now, because of a lot of different things, there aren't as many. So we're hoping that with responsible captive rearing, we can help the numbers to start coming back again.
So is it the usual suspects, pesticides, yada, yada, all that stuff?
I call it the four Ps. And they're, pesticides, predators, parasitoids, and parasites.
What's a parasitoid?
A parasitoid is sort of not quite a parasite, but it would be.
What are you thinking? It's just like
tachinid flies or draconid wasps or.
It's a predator. But...
Well, they're insects that lay eggs on the caterpillar.
Oh,
and
I see.
So
they're taking advantage of the nutrients inside the.
Right.
Yeah.
For instance, in the case of the tachinid or tea flies,
yeah.
They literally lay eggs inside the caterpillar.
Oh, that's nasty.
And some wasps do the same thing mm-hmm. as well. Tiny, tiny little wasps. What happens is you may have your caterpillar go through all of its molts and even form a chrysalis. And so now you've gotten all of your work done. You've fed them all of this milkweed. You've babied them through all of the stages. And, something can go wrong at any stage, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So, but when it gets into a chrysalis, you feel pretty safe that it'll be okay.
Right.
Except there's the occasional one that will have T-fly infection. And what happened is you look at the green chrysalis, and there's a little white string hanging down from it. And I thought, how did that get in the cage? And then I noticed that on the floor of the cage, there was a little maggot, not the most beautiful thing to see. And that just meant that it had hatched from the inside of the butterfly.
And so it's not
viable. Yeah. So this is not for the faint of heart. There are certain things that happen occasionally. But, that's why they do stand a much better chance. In the wild, if you left the eggs outdoors, only 2% of them would actually survive to become a butterfly. If you bring them indoors, you can get that up to about 90%. So just by removing them from all of the normal
predators and
everything else, right?
Wow. So this was noticed that only, what did you say, the population declined by 85%, something like
95%,
that?
95%, I think.
95%. Right. Mm-hmm. When was that noticed?
It's been going down over the course of time. They do counts or estimates every year, and we had gone down quite a bit until about a few years ago, and then it started going up again. But the numbers for this year, I'm not quite sure yet. I heard one report where it was drastically lower, and then I heard another report that said no, they're just later in the season this time, and so we're waiting for the final numbers on that.
But there have been some resurgence.
It's a little, but the trend is beginning to get better.
Do you think that's because you've been helping them?
Well, if everybody helps, then that would be better. But I hope. I like to think that we're doing our part.
Yeah, for sure. So we started talking about the track. So from BC, British Columbia, mm-hmm. down to California, at least
right.
Central California, if not Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
On the East Coast, they also start in Canada and end up in Mexico?
Yes.
Excuse me.
Yes, that's correct.
Wow. So that's what, 3,000 miles or something?
Yeah, and they can cover as much as, people say 25 miles a day. I think they can go further than that. I think
wow.
they can go closer to 50 miles. And a lot of it is, flying on thermals or just,
mm-hmm. so. Taking advantage of the currents and all
right,
that.
Right, exactly. And it was interesting, the three of mine that were found were released during the height of the Chetco Bar fire. So I think they just got outside and tried to smell what they could smell and said, I'm getting out of here.
30,000 right? feet and just coasted, right, on
right.
that hot air. Oh, that's funny. Okay, so that, I think that's one of the big deals that people are so fascinated is how far they go, those little delicate things,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And so what about the rest of the world? I understand they have them in New Zealand and lots of other places.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just got back from New Zealand last month, and I thought, well, this is great. I'm on vacation, so
right.
I don't have to worry about butterflies at home because it's not the season. Well, of course, the seasons there are reversed and from here, being south of the equator. And I was in Christchurch at their botanical gardens, and of course, I ran into six monarch butterflies and was following them around and taking pictures of them to the amusement of many other tourists, but it was nice to see, and I'm pretty sure based on the pictures that I took that they're the exact same as the ones that that we have. I mean, there could be a little genetic drift because
uh-huh.
New Zealand is isolated, but
do you know anything about their migratory patterns? Is it the same all over the world?
Well,
they go these intensely long flights.
No, it would be different for a place like New Zealand because I don't know that they know much about the migratory pathways. I thought I heard someone in Australia say that they tend to migrate toward Sydney, but it really depends on where there's a protected enough environment that has just the right meteorological conditions to support
the old world. What about Europe and Asia and Africa?
I'm not as familiar with I'm not as familiar with Africa. In Europe, I know they have butterflies. I would assume they would have monarchs, but I really don't know for sure. So
okay.
I don't want to
okay. So anyway, we're talking about these guys. What can we do to help as being part of being a monarch city?
Oh, yeah, great. I would encourage anybody who can to plant some milkweed if they have any available space in their yard. As I said before, that's the host plant for the female monarchs to lay the eggs on and for the caterpillars to eat as food. And if, you know, as I also said, we would benefit overall if you try to put in, you know, a pollinator garden that would attract, you know, everything from bees to butterflies to hummingbirds or
so those
whatever.
Are usually, as I recall, it's usually the pink and the red flowers?
They vary. The amount of pollen and nectar are not the same.
Right.
So nectar is really sugar. And from what I understand, flowers can vary from between 8% and 50% sugar levels. And so it's the higher sugar levels. I know they really seem to like zinnias. Joe Pye weed is another plant. I'm not sure that it's native to Oregon. The Mexican sunflowers, Tithonia, I think is the name of it. There's several other ones. I know what I did last year was I bought a few packets of non-GMO seeds at a local store and planted them just behind my Escalonia hedges, which is my shelter for them.
Uh-huh.
And so there all sorts of wildflowers came up, and they would just, you know, hop around on those.
So they want the nectar flowers.
Right.
The higher nectar as possible.
Right. Especially the super migration that has to, I'm sorry, the super generation that has to migrate.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. And so do you have any like URLs, websites, things that we can do to look this up if we want to find out more about what are high nectar flowers or anything specific to the monarchs? You mentioned a couple of different organizations.
Right.
Let's talk about those now. Mm-hmm. And then maybe at the very end we can say them again for anybody who missed writing them down just now.
Sure. Okay. The place, if you're interested in starting a Monarch Way Station, I believe the link is monarchwatch.org. There's another society called the Xerces, X-E-R-C-E-S Society.
Uh-huh.
That also has very interesting things. There's, one of the best ways is if you're on Facebook, go to the monarchs.me, Facebook page, and you'll get to hear from a lot of other people who have been through a lot of experiences. Everybody from very well experienced to you know, newbies in the field, and you know, no question is unimportant. I mean, if you have a question, you just ask, and people are helpful to you and can refer you also to other websites. I'm sorry, I didn't bring a list with me, so
that's
I don't have
but
it.
I mean, it gives us a place to start.
Sure, right.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So in terms of your own experience, you've been raising these little guys for quite a while now, I think, a few years.
Yeah, just about 3 years now, yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that entail? Is it
a big commitment? Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love to talk about it.
Let's hear a little bit more.
So first of all, you don't even start this unless you're growing milkweed and already have it growing and you have quite a bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because caterpillars, or as Vicky likes to call them, caterpiggles, eat a lot of milkweed, especially as they get bigger. So you want to have the host plant. And then I go out once or twice a day during the season and see if I can find any eggs usually on the bottoms of the milkweed leaves. They're tiny. They're only a little more than the size of a head of a pin. That's about right. And so I would go out, cut the leaf off that the egg is on, and then lay that leaf on top of a fresh leaf in a little moist chamber with paper towels, and wait until it hatches. When it hatches, you'll see just a tiny little black part at the top of the egg, and then the caterpillar will come out. The first thing it does is eat its egg, and then it starts munching on the milkweed leaves.
They must be tiny. So
they're extremely tiny. I would say they're about, a quarter the size of a grain of rice at the most.
Wow.
They're really, really small.
Yeah.
And So that's the stage that you don't even want to put them into a mesh cage because they could even squeeze through the yeah. mesh. So what they'll do then is they'll so the first caterpillar is called the first instar. Instar is what we call one of the phases of caterpillar between mm-hmm. molts. Mm-hmm. And so it'll molt four times, and then the fifth time, eating progressively more and more milkweed.
Molting as in losing its skin.
And losing its skin, which it will frequently eat also.
Runs out of room in its skin and has to find a new one.
Yeah. And they grow very, very quickly.
How long does it take them to go from that size to like the mature size before they're ready to go in the chrysalis?
Right. Well, they'll hatch from the egg in about 3 days after you find the egg. Mm-hmm. And then they go through five larval phases, the instars, and that's probably a total of 14 days for all five. And then they're about, on average, between 11 and 15 days in the chrysalis form. So it's
so
probably 11 about 30 days
before they hit the chrysalis.
Right.
And they go from that little tiny thing to how big are they when they do the chrysalis?
They're about 2 inches long.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's an enormous amount of difference. Yeah, and they eat tons and tons and tons. So
I bet they do.
It really is amazing.
Yeah.
And so then you have after the caterpillars molt twice and they're in their third phase, I'll move them into a 15 by 15 inch cube that has nylon mesh all the way around it and a zipper to open it. And you always have to be careful when you open the zipper not to make sure there's a caterpillar behind the other side of it. And, I always have to vacuum the cages out to get rid of the frass, as in frass happens.
Yeah, right.
It's important to keep them as clean as possible to avoid introducing any diseases. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't keep caterpillars in the same cage that you have butterflies because butterflies can transmit things to caterpillars and things.
Right.
I even have to remember, I give my dogs a topical flea medication on their backs. And if I was petting them before, I always have to wash my hands before
oh, sure.
I even touch
yeah.
the caterpillars. And so it's... It's really interesting, but they when they're ready to go into chrysalis, they do something very weird. They spin a little silk button and put that at the top, on the very top of the cage.
Mm-hmm.
And then they very, very carefully insert a cremaster, which is just a little pointy part, into that. And they hang in the form of a J. So it looks like they're basically dying. And their antennas, or what they used to have for them are just sort of hanging limp in the cage and you're convinced it's dead. But that's the most critical part of them forming the chrysalis. You can't go anywhere near it. I mean, you don't even want to breathe on it. And so then what happens is after a while, after probably about, I would say 18 to 48 hours, it will start spinning and just rotating around. And as it does that, you start seeing the green as it is shedding its last skin with the chrysalis right underneath it. So it's splitting along that, and then you end up with this beautiful chrysalis with little gold dots on it, and that takes about, as I said, about 2 weeks on average for the butterfly to emerge.
Wow, so the chrysalis is actually under its skin. It's not something that it's growing on top. It splits open and it's already there.
Yeah, and it becomes the skin of
fascinating. So
basically,
really
right.
interesting.
Yeah.
So then it takes another couple of weeks, and then the butterfly comes out.
Right, and when the butterfly first comes out, it emerges and just sort of drops, but it's still hanging on,
mm-hmm.
and it's tiny. It you think, well, how, you know, I thought this was supposed to be an adult butterfly, but it takes about 3 full hours for its wings to, it has to pump its hemolymph or blood into its wings, and then it gets bigger and bigger.
Uh-huh.
And frequently you'll see a little red spot on the bottom of the cage right underneath where the chrysalis was, and that's actually called meconium, and it's the waste products that were created while the butterfly was in chrysalis formation. But I know it freaks little kids out when they see it. They
it's
think,
bleeding.
Oh, my butterfly's bleeding, right?
Yeah.
But it's a natural process, and you don't want to release the butterflies any sooner than 3 hours after they've emerged, because they need to make sure that their wings are strong enough so that they can fly. So, but it's just fascinating when you think about it, because when you think about what the chrysalis is, a lot of people used to think, well, it's just sort of a larval soup or something. You know, how does it, how does a caterpillar become something as beautiful as a butterfly? And throughout its existence, there are certain groups of cells that are predestined to become the different parts of the butterfly. And those carry through, even though it dissolves almost everything else. And then those remember to form what it has to form. It's miraculous. I mean, I don't know any other word for it. It's just amazing. It's wonderful. Yeah. And really to see amazing. It, you know, close and up front is really, really fantastic.
So can this be done at any time of year? It can only be done when the eggs are available.
Right.
Which is when?
They should start coming around, I would say, you know, June or so here.
Okay. And, so once a year you get a chance to witness this whole thing and be part of it.
Right. From about June till, I think I released my last one last year in October.
Right. So there's a few months there,
yeah.
The summer season.
And I have about 7 or 8 cubes at home, so my whole living room is full of full
right.
of these during the season. So.
Don't mind the butterflies. Have a seat. So, okay, you're a biologist by trade, is that right?
Yes,
and,
yes.
Just in case there might be any young people out there, what fascinated you with getting into biology in the first place? Can you remember back?
I knew that I loved science since I was a kid and had my little play dinosaurs to play with and things.
Right.
But I just took to science. It was something that always fascinated me. And the living world around us is just full of you know, wonder.
And I can see how you light up talking about the butterflies. I
mean,
it's really a privilege to be part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. So I encourage any children or young adults who might be listening to take STEM classes and science classes and see if there's something that interests you. And I worked at a number of different companies. I worked at research organizations, academic institutions, biotech, biopharmaceutical companies, most recently in cancer immunotherapy up in Portland.
Oh, that's interesting. That's worth a show right there.
Oh, yeah. I also had a 5-year job on the Big Island of Hawaii studying diseases in rainforest birds, which was really nice chance to have that. So.
Yeah.
So I got my bachelor's degree at Fordham University and my master's degree at the City University of New York, Hunter College. And I've just been
off you went.
Yeah.
So as a city councilor now, otherwise, are you a retired person?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
I keep myself busier a lot of times than when I was working. But
So how did you get involved in local government from this background? Like, what was the evolution?
I'm an atypical quote unquote politician. It's good that I'm on the city council. A lot of people don't know that I'm a bit of an introvert, and I try as much as I can to hide that. So I try to get involved in things that just push my boundaries a little bit to make myself a better person.
I understand that perfectly.
And so I'm certainly not on the council for any ego gratification or anything. I just like to be.
You're not going
to
be a lobbyist when you grow up, or
no,
anything.
No, absolutely not. No, but I really enjoy working with people and listening to people and hearing what they have to say, and public service is just perfect. That now that I'm retired, I have the time to do it, and I really enjoy it. And I work with a lot of really nice people, and we don't always agree on things on the council. And I view my role on the council as having been a scientist as being different than the other people who have lived here longer.
Uh-huh.
I've only lived here for 4 years now. They who have more experiences in different things. So I'll defer to them if it's an area that I'm not strong in. And if it comes to something that has an environmental ramification or something, I'm happy to weigh in from a scientific viewpoint. So I try to at least sort of find some sort of niche that can satisfy the scientists in me. But at the same point, I decided to retire here in Brookings, and so I thought I'd like to be a part of knowing what's going on.
Keeps you really involved in the community, participating,
exactly,
and all of that.
Exactly. And you know, I like also working with nonprofits and just meeting as many people as possible. Everybody has a life story to tell.
For sure.
And everybody has experiences.
Yeah.
And once we start talking to each other, just in a civil manner, even if we disagree, we can both learn something. So, so I think it's it makes me feel good when I'm helping other people. I don't know what else to say other than that. I was a caregiver for a while many years ago. I worked at the San Diego AIDS Project and as a volunteer. And that was really during the darkest days of the crisis before they know what even, you know, caused
what
it.
What was going on, yeah.
And I'd been with several patients as they passed, and they didn't have anyone else there, and I was just a representative of the organization. But it made me feel good that I helped, you know, somebody was there to talk to
needed.
Them. And I get, you know, I just think that, you know, for some reason, I'm one of those people that it makes me feel good to help other people, and I do my best. I know I won't satisfy everybody, and I know we might disagree, but please talk to me.
Well, I think most of us that have had the opportunity to serve others find that it's very satisfying, and mm-hmm. and I think that's a very human experience if you have the opportunity to have it.
Right.
You know, a lot of people can't afford to help yeah. other people and so forth. So I feel really blessed when we have those opportunities.
And we're lucky here in Brookings. We have a ton of volunteers that are ready yeah. to do things. And that's what I, you know, having been born in New York City and then now living in a much smaller city, especially during the CHETCO bar fire, when everybody came together to help each other. And it was just remarkable. I mean, it made me feel good. I would go home and I would smile. I would just feel really happy about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I was going to say a personal admission here. I've followed national politics quite a bit, but I skipped civics class in high school, and I don't really know much about the structure of our local government. Mm-hmm. Now, city council, how does that, you say yay or nay to different programs, things like of that nature. There's also the mayor. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And how do these pieces fit together? Can you give me like the kindergarten bonehead description?
Yeah, I'll try since I'm new to this also, but relatively.
Okay.
The mayor is actually one of the city, is one of the city council.
Is he like the head of the council, so to speak?
We don't have what's called a strong mayor. So I don't mean that about
more like
about
you just all co-facilitate.
Yes. The city council is the governing body of the city of Brookings. The city manager supervises the staff individually and takes care of a lot of things. We've been blessed to have Gary Milliman as our city manager in
a
number of ways.
And you folks are in charge of directing him and hiring him and all of that?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. The city council is in charge of hiring the city manager. I think it might be the city recorder also and the police chief. If I'm right,
okay.
I think other ones can be filled by the city manager, but we generally will look at different things that as they come before us. I mean, if there are you know, bids coming in for a public works project, we'll give the final okay on you know, which ones to choose. We always have, when an issue comes before us, we're given ample opportunity beforehand to research it. I tend to do a little bit more research than some of the others, so I've been told. I always get, Dennis has done his homework again.
Right.
And that's my answer to them. It's yeah. the only way I know, right?
Yeah, right.
but anyway, it's been a lot of fun, and I hope to be able to do it for another 4 years. I was appointed the first time, but if I get mm-hmm. elected this November.
Sounds good. So there's a lot of facilitating of things like grants and different proposals mm-hmm. that people want to make happen.
Right.
But from a funding perspective, you really don't have income because the property tax goes to the county and the state tax obviously goes to the state. Most of your funding is going to come through what, grants and maybe the what we call the tourist tax.
We get money from a lot of different places. Grants being one of them. I mean, a lot of the improvements that have been done in Azalea Park as of late were predominantly grant funded. There are sometimes that the city has to pay maybe 40%, and the grant would pay the other 60%, and there are some stipulations in between. But grants are a good source of revenue for us. We also get money from the water bills and the wastewater treatment, and revenue does come in. I mean, last year our budget, our total budget was about, if I remember, $22 million for the for the year, and we try to keep about 5% of that in a contingency fund when we do the budget, which we're in the process of doing now. I'm happy to say that with our current finance director, we've had 9 years of straight audits, clean audits at the city. So things are being done well. And the budget committee consists of up to 10 members, including the 5 councilors and 5 members of the public.
Okay.
And we've had 2 workshops already, and we're going to have the first budget meeting, I think, on the 26th of this month, 26th of April. And that'll probably be the first time that we'll be looking at a draft budget and soliciting input also from people.
So, I got to ask the bonehead question. Will we have city police, for instance? Who pays for that? Does that come out of that budget?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Public safety comes is a big part of the budget.
Okay, so that those kinds of things come out of your budgetary concerns, mm-hmm. And I often hear that we're pretty broke. Is that so?
I would say that the county is in a more dire financial situation than Brookings is.
Worse than the city.
Yes, definitely.
Mm.
Yeah,
okay.
Brookings, from what I see, seems to be doing okay.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you can say too much more about the county versus the city budgetary problems. Is there any, I mean, I realize you're not connected to the county so much as the
right.
city, but is there any good thoughts on the horizon about the county situation? Is that something that you have any insight into?
What it seems to me, just from reading, I have not even been to a county commissioner's meeting, but it seems that they've cut spending drastically to try to keep up with things. But what it seems to me that is the most important is that they need to raise more revenue in one way or another.
Uh-huh.
So it's really a revenue generating thing. And I know some of the candidates. I was at the League of Women Voters candidate forum. Several of the voters had some ideas about how they might generate more revenue for the county. And in addition, I think they were getting money through the secure rural schools system that was supposed to be cut off, but I think they extended it for 2 more years. So that sort of gets them out of at least a little bit, you know, that would
right.
make them have to cut less. But again, I'm not really, I don't really follow every detail
right.
of the county.
Because they've been talking about going to 4-day weeks at the school and some pretty scary steps that I would hate to see have to
right.
happen.
Right, yeah.
And not only mm-hmm. for the sake of the kids, but the poor parents that actually could try to hold down jobs.
Exactly.
So what else is on the agenda in terms of the council? Like you have, I think you mentioned something about medical concerns and public comments and so on. What are some of the things that are foremost in your mind these days?
I would say, you know, one of the things that I'd really like to see is, you know, more jobs here that are reasonable, more affordable housing here, so that you know, we can house more of our more people. the healthcare here, although it's sort of a catch-22 because we're so rural and because we don't have that much affordable housing here, you really can't bring in the people to support hospitals.
The people
or
in terms
things.
Of staffing, you mean?
Staffing, right.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people will move here, and then after a while, because they're enamored by our natural beauty with the ocean on one side and the redwoods on the other. But then they find after a while that it's just that they don't have the conveniences maybe necessarily that they had wherever they lived before, and so they don't stay long. I think things are getting better. There are some things that are going on behind the scenes. I think the future can be bright, and I'm hopeful that that things will move.
Okay, when you say behind the scenes, now I have to ask.
Oh no.
What's behind that curtain?
No. Our government, as far as I know, is completely transparent.
But seriously, when you say there's some bright spots out there, what kind of things are you thinking on the horizon, possibly?
I don't know. I'm hoping that we could get a hospital in Brookings. Ultimately, There's so many bureaucratic things that sort of seem to bump up against each other when you try to get something.
Sure.
Like everybody wants an emergency room in Brookings, but the CMS, I think it's called the Center for Medicaid Services, that reimburses people for Medicare. I believe that they frown on sort of standalone emergency rooms. But, and also they'd probably at best only have to stabilize you if there's not a hospital associated with the emergency room until they then transport you somewhere else. So you're basically having to make two trips.
Right, with all the red tape that involves.
Right. So we're at the level now that, we're talking to, people in the city, people in the county, and people at the federal level to see, at the state level also, and the federal level to see what could possibly be done. So that's why I say behind the scenes, not really behind the scenes, but there's just a lot of people working on it.
I know, I was just teasing. But thinking about, like, you have to deal with land use issues, this affordable housing issue, to my mind, we just did a show on this last week on Brookings Cafe, about the outlook for Brookings, and one of the things really holding us back is affordable housing, and it's not going to get any better from everything that we can see coming down the road, that, there's going to be a bit of a scarcity, no matter what the economy does, because it can go up and down and all that, but just the inventory of homes that are out there is pretty much limited. They're not building anymore, really.
Right.
Craftsmen are gone, and the cost of materials is sky high, and the regulations, and on and on and on it goes. So the affordability of housing puts a limit on so many things that we could be doing in this town, but we can't have workers to do that, those things for us.
Exactly.
And that's really seems like it's the obstacle that cuts across a lot of different issues.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's another reason why if we don't do something, it seems to me that a lot of students, once they hit 18, will just take a beeline up to Portland.
Oh, and they're out of here.
Where they can get a decent job. Well, not everybody is meant to go to university. I mean, there are people who excel in different vocational things, and and our high school has a robotics department and some other departments where students can learn welding and other things, and those skills should work no matter what town you live in, especially a small town if people need help. So I think we just need to do a bit more and just solicit more input from all of the stakeholders that are involved. And
one of the rumors that I keep hearing bandied about lately is how we need a trade school, that people in the trades, for instance, that we just don't have enough. All the tradespeople, the really skilled people, are retiring now, and nobody is there to take their place.
Right.
And there's been such an emphasis on sending people to college that those trades have just gone without new people to replace the old guys. And if we had that here, maybe a lot more of our people would stay. In fact, as a realtor, I see a lot of folks who would like to build, but they're held back by the fact that they can't get a contractor to commit to anything in anywhere near a reasonable time frame because they can't get the help.
Right. No, I agree. That would be something that would be good. And even people who are in the vocational field, if they have to get certificates or whatever, you know, as they're continuing their skill sets and building their skill sets, they have to go out of town probably to go to a seminar because we don't have that that here. So it would be convenient to just remember that, you know, yes, there are universities and they're very nice, but not for everybody.
And they're awfully expensive, too. I mean, they don't hardly pay them off.
Oh, yeah.
Pay for themselves in the long run.
Exactly.
Well, we're getting down to the end of our time frame here. I realize I have one last real question of you, which is, what do you think is our outlook? My feeling is that we're getting a lot of new people in town all the time. Mm-hmm. The census doesn't necessarily reflect that because it's only once every 10 years.
Right.
But are you privy to any projections about growth and things like that? Any outlook information that you can give us?
Right. Right now, I don't think that our population is growing all that much because, mm-hmm. you're when you look at the total population, you're counting people who have passed away or moved away versus people
right.
who are moving in. But I can give you an example. I was at a party a few days ago, and there were probably about 50 people there. And at one point we asked, how many people in the room have moved here within the last year? And about a quarter of them had raised their hand.
Exactly.
And then we asked, how many of you have moved here within 2 years? 50%. So
right.
we're getting a lot of people in, whether they're retirees maybe from California or
other places
or
too,
people
yeah.
who just love the natural environment as much as
mm-hmm,
I do,
mm-hmm.
Then you know they are coming and, mm-hmm. and it could change the demographic a little bit also. And they will also have certain expectations, I would imagine, if they come from places. For instance, we don't have a performing arts center or some place with an auditorium where we could host a convention or get music groups together or and acting groups that could all, you know, use this. And if we did that, I think that would be a boon to Brookings. So the people coming in will have certain you know, ideas also. And I think, you know, diversity is great. I think, you know, hearing from more people and the way that things were done where they lived and,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, the more people you talk to, you really start getting some ideas.
We do have amazing resources here.
We really do. We're very fortunate.
And what about tourism? We have a pretty healthy tourist economy here. Mm-hmm. Is there any news on the horizon of that you might be able to give us feedback about? Or is it pretty much same as usual, or
there are the Brookings has a commission, several commissions and committees in town, and the Tourism Promotion Advisory Committee or TPAC is given a certain amount of money that is raised by the city in transient occupancy tax revenue, and what their goal is to help sponsor applicants who apply to the Tourism Promotion Committee for grants to help them put on a new event, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people in town who put on multiple events a year. And I mean, it ranges from races to, different tournaments.
Festivals.
Sailing festivals.
Music, right.
And so they... what the Tourism Promotion Committee looks at is whether or not that will bring people into Brookings so that can stimulate our local economy with tourist dollars as well. So I'm very hopeful about the future here.
I am too.
I really think the new people coming in is great, and I'm meeting new people every day, which is great for me.
So. And I find so many of the new folks coming in who got so much to offer. We have a lot of resources. We have the beautiful nature
mm-hmm.
resource
Absolutely.
Around us, but we also have people resources.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just amazed all the time at the
right.
amazing depth and breadth of knowledge and know-how that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely, a lot can happen with that.
Yeah, and as I mentioned before, volunteers are the lifeblood of a community, and we're really fortunate to have a lot of volunteers involved with several really good nonprofit organizations, whether it's the food bank helping to feed those in need, or all other groups, the animal shelters and things, and it's great. And I've even had some work parties up in Azalea Park to help prune the azaleas to make sure that they grow back well, because they'd been sort of overgrown with berries and other things. And and we've had as many as 30 people show up on a rainy Saturday to help pull out the weeds and trim some of the plants, including the master gardeners. So it's been great, and it's a wonderful way to meet people of a like mind with you if you're doing a project that you both share an interest for.
Yeah, for sure. So we were going to say again those URLs and groups that are involved with the butterflies in terms of volunteering. I mean,
sure,
if you have land that you want to put into milkweed or any of these kinds of things that people could do to get involved at different levels. Do you want to get back to that a little bit?
Sure. As I said, if you can plant some milkweed, that's the plant that the monarchs need to lay their eggs on and the caterpillars need to eat in order to become adults.
Any old milkweed will do?
I prefer using native milkweed. It's really interesting. In my own garden, I have 7 different varieties of milkweed, and 3 are native and 4 are non-native. So whereas the caterpillars, as they get bigger, will eat any of them, the monarch females will only lay their eggs on the native milkweed,
at
least in my experience.
Yeah.
So they know. And it's just, again, another just amazing thing about how they do it. But it's just all really, really fascinating. And I would encourage people to, at the very least, plant milkweed. If you're interested in a monarch way station in your own backyard or on your property, I would contact monarchwatch.org and see what the specifications are for that. It can be as little as 50 square feet. It doesn't have to be a big space. And you could even get a sign for it, and they give you a certificate with a specific number for your garden. And it's just a great way to help.
I imagine once you do that, then you can get connected with all kinds of people
absolutely
all over the country that
absolutely
are involved in this.
And if you go to
their
website, they'll even show you on a map where all of the different Monarch Way stations are. And so if you click on it, it'll have your name and the way station number also. Just in general, I would just encourage, planting. I mean, I'm also a master gardener, so I love plants. I grew up in a florist shop that was run by my Italian grandparents who were immigrants at the time. And so I've always been around plants and plant things that will attract bees and try to avoid pesticides unless you absolutely need to use them. I mean, a few pests in your yard are really not that bad.
Just grow more.
Right, exactly. and butterflies love dandelions too. So, it's
good to know.
If you have some, growing in your back 40.
That shouldn't be a problem.
Require no fertilizer, right?
Well, Dennis, you're going to be up for election next November.
Yes.
And I just wish you really well with that. I think you're just the most wonderfully exciting, well-intentioned person to be around and to listen to.
Thank you. That's really kind.
And I thank you very much for being on the show.
Oh, no
appreciate
problem. Thank you so much
here
for having me.
And this has been Reality Check, KCIW. Thank you for listening.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.